Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Richard St. John. Richard St. John is Executive Director of Conversations for Commonwealth, a nonprofit program that uses poetry and other materials to help people connect across difference, respond to the ethical callings in their lives, and translate that response into generous action in the world. His first book of poems, The Pure Inconstancy of Grace, has just been released by Truman State University Press. Hi, Richard. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. Thank you for letting me be here.
Sure. I'm really excited about your book, and I want to say congratulations.
Well, thank you. It's been a long time coming, and I'm delighted, and I'm thankful for your support.
Sure. So you're going to start with some poems from the book?
Yes. Okay. Yes, I will. Thank you. My wife, Kate, is kind of a self-trained naturalist, and she goes hiking every weekend. And one November, not far from our wedding anniversary, she brought back a deer skull that she found while she was hiking. And, well, of course, that sort of thing gets you thinking. And this poem is called Praying in the Dark, Age 50. It's still a little bit mysterious to me. It's in two parts. The first, not surprisingly, takes kind of a hard look at mortality and kind of implicitly asks, is this it? You know, and in this section, the deer skull sort of functions as kind of a magical divining rod. The second part looks to kind of deep human relationships for some glimmer of response or resolution. Praying in the dark, age 50. And there's an epigraph from Song of Songs. My beloved is like a gazelle. One. I sit in the dark. It is almost our anniversary. I hold the skull of a deer my wife brought home. Make no mistake, this is where we're going. The pristine bone, the empty brain case, the jaw half gone. One light branch of antler in each hand, I follow it down. The shattered nose sniffs along the ground. The enormous sockets, vacant and round, my only vision. We pick our way across invisible wet snow. Dark deer runs, arched with bramble, along a shaly hill. We clamber a black culvert, down and down, through fissures, crevices, where only water goes, down rock. Through stone. We've reached the end, the black and lapidary heart of things. Two. I loose the antlers now and cradle the empty vessel that you brought. The darkness here is almost intimate. I run my hands along the four tectonic plates of four skull, feel the stitch-like line of pinholes where they join. Along the half jaw left, the teeth are oddly loose and light, like maize. Inside the skull case, something flickers like black flame. I sit in silence. The deep earth shifts and breathes. Bedrock, fittedness. I follow unseen water down. I kiss you in the dark. I drink. Well, my wife, Kate, complains that, and I think unfairly, that there's too much death in my poems. And so it kind of became a joke in our household when they interviewed Billy Collins, and they were talking about how funny his poems were. And then they noted, but, you know, you still do write about death a lot. And Collins responded, why, death? That's what gets us poets up in the morning. So if you'll bear with me, this next poem is an elegy, and it was written for a friend in community development. Her son, who led a very steady life as a technician in a hospital, was killed in a drive-by shooting as he was returning home. They lived in Manchester, but this poem is kind of set not very far from here at WYEP on the Southside Slopes. It's a loosely rhymed poem, and it starts with an epigraph from Yeats. The darkened mosaic. For Rhonda Brandon and her son, LaRue. And here's the epigraph. I am happy, and I think full of an energy. of an energy I had despaired of. It seems to me that I have found what I wanted. When I try to put all in a phrase, I say, man can embody truth, but he cannot know it. That's W.B. Yeats in a letter 2 weeks before his death. The night I learned your son was shot, I went past the boarded monastery, up steep pious street, past the crooked graying teeth of houses on their Appalachian lots, past the parents joking on the wooden stoops, to the little asphalt playground at the top, with the city stretching out beneath. A woman swept her walk. Kids scuffled hockey sticks and chased the fading puck across the pavement, less by sight than sound. A girl spun her younger brother on the twirl around. And on the swings, two boys arched their backs and stretched, reaching their shoe tips up toward the twisted X's of the fence-top mesh. On the hillside steps, some older kids hung out. The noise of radios marked out a space for them to talk and watch the city lights come on. How could they play or swing or sit? How could that woman keep on sweeping in the face of it? Not just your son, but the whole city, it seems, undone. Kids smash the street lights, trash collections down to every other week. Still, she sweeps, although it does no good. She's only moving grit from place to place, knocking a pebble loose and scuffing the rusted reinforcement rods exposed beneath, like bones in an X-ray scan, or watching her sweep like cords across the back of her extended hand. Maybe your son was just the small gray knuckle of a stone somewhere in the crumbling urban aggregate. After all, what had he really done at 22? A medical supply technician, steady at the hospital, affectionate to his fiancée and you. And yet, that woman bent to her broom in the coming dark, in accord with mysteries beyond effect, a structure or a rightness running through. Her sweeping and the swinging up and out and the children swinging like the constellations on the twirl about all make a motion, and the motion with the structure brings, unseen, a burnishing. And with this burnishing, the stones become a sprawled mosaic, every burnished stone alight among the city lights spread out below. The pale peach vapor lamps in rows along the highways, the moving glimmer of a bus, the bluer street lights coming on, and lights of houses, every light a room, each room an individual. I try to picture it, a wall of inlaid fire, the whole perfected city. But something else appears, more like a human face, like his or yours.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Richard St. John, reading from his new book, The Pure Inconstancy of Grace. Richard, I want to ask you about structure in your poems. It seems to me there's a lot of structure. The sections of your book are titled, you have a lot of epigraphs. Your lines have a feeling that they could only break where you have broken them, and you have section poems, poems of the same stanza length, etc. There's a sort of containment of sorts there. And do you think structure works as almost a character or another speaker in your poems?
As a character or another speaker? I guess I've never looked at it that way. But I have always sensed that, for better or worse, if you go on the spectrum of raw poetry and cooked poetry, as they like to say, I'm pretty far on the cooked end, for better or worse. And occasionally I regret that, but I think you write the kind of poems generally that you tend to write, and minor meditative, and I think that lends itself to a kind of reflection and a kind of structure, sometimes at the cost of perhaps immediacy, and we all have costs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I wasn't, you know, I wasn't, it wasn't at all a critique.
Sorry, I didn't hear it that way.
Okay. I think it's really interesting how it's sort of like a different level of attention being paid to the poems and care that I think really works in the poems and in the book. And you know, I wasn't setting up a dichotomy with, you know, structured and raw, but more like, you know, almost like there's so much of it that it's almost starts to act in a different way in the book. And I was trying to get to it, but.
Okay. I mean, I guess I think of it more as a perhaps container rather than a character.
Mm-hmm.
And it does a, and I think overall shape is important, the kind of shape of the book and the shape of a poem and the shape of a line.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I also wanted to ask you about convergence. You know, when I think of your work, I think of convergence and transformation. It seems like you always take us to a place where ideas and people meet in the poems, and then we're delivered to a new place that seems to me always has some kind of possibility. Does that ring true at all to you about your work?
Yeah, I think it rings true. They're poems of thinking, but I also hope that they're very much poems of people in the real world. And because I think in a very broad sense, I'm coming from a religious perspective, I think even when I'm looking at something that's, you know, you look at things straight on and they're often pretty dark, but I think that, you know, leads to a kind of hopefulness underneath it all.
Mm-hmm. By religious, what do you mean exactly?
Well, I'm tempted to read a poem in answer to that, but I mean, I guess what I mean
that'd be good.
Okay. But I guess what I mean is I'm really, you know, I would define myself as a Christian. I'm writing from a Christian tradition, but I mean that in a very broad sense. And so to set a context, I guess I'd say, you know, if someone comes up to me and says, well, do you think that Jesus is God? My answer to that is, I don't think that's a very interesting question. I don't think that's what faith is about. The faith is about more something about fidelity. What's the direction of our lives? What are we going to lean toward? What are we going to hearken toward? Mm-hmm. So I don't find the sort of belief sets of questions, the checklist of propositions, very interesting at all.
Okay.
And I could read a poem that a little bit speaks to that.
It may not, on the
surface, sound like a religious poem. As I said, my wife is a naturalist and a bird watcher, and so she and birds turn up in my poems, even though I think of myself as a kind of an urban poet. This poem is called The Metaphysics of Thrushes. Leaving the bookstore, where I'd been skimming Problem of the Soul, we turn past the t-shirt shops, ice cream parlors, restaurants. No one is going anywhere in particular. We pass the doorway of a bar. A bright eddy of noise swirls out and fades, then reach some sleepy residential streets. Suddenly, Kate stops. She cups her ears and looks straight up. Listen, she hushes. I hear just the autumn wind through treetops, but she hops forward. Three quick steps, then stops again. They're there. The thrushes. At last, I hear a tinny z, z, z. She's running, almost dancing now, as if to catch them high above. Half a palm long, mere fluff with mottled breasts, flitting through shadows, streetlight, in this quirky quest, clapping with joy and calling, sweethearts, and again, my sweethearts. She is at her best. From the sharp darkness, the thrushes call, z, z, elusive, staticky. In the streets below, almost unheard, Night after night, they make their distant way. Fragile, steadfast, leaning toward. Okay. Maybe if you'd like me to read a little bit, I'll give you a break from death and move on to something in the other end of the life spectrum. This is a poem for my sister-in-law, Mary, who as a single mother adopted an infant daughter in Russia. And at the same time she was there, my wife and I were in Florence. And this poem is set in the monastery of San Marco, a location that's famous for Fra Angelico's Annunciation. The painting depicts, of course, the moment when the angel gives the Virgin Mary the message of a new child. And while I was photographing the painting, a young girl stepped into my photograph, and the poem kind of conflates all of these characters, Mary and the angel, my sister-in-law, Mary, the new child, the young girl who steps into the photo. It's called Annunciations. To me, it's a mystery what happened that moment there in that broom-swept Russian orphanage, the instant you met your new daughter, the uncertain air and nothing else between you. I was in Florence, climbing the stair at San Marco, to where, in my photo, a girl I hadn't intended is entering the frame. She steps into the space of Fra Angelico's most famous fresco. Her knee is slightly bent, like the angel's beside her. Its wings a stiff tracery of gold and copper, mauve and verdigris. Her hair is dark, like yours, her face a frown. The one arm I can see is folded on her chest, the way that Mary's are, covering, I guess, a hidden purse. Is she with a student group and trying to keep pace with her talky guide and hissing, wished-for friends? Or just lagging out of sight of distant parents? But what I wonder is, the real question in all these annunciations, will she say yes to the God within her? That unknown something she might at her best become? Just barely a hunch, an intuition, and so ill-formed, what a bastardish thing it looks like now. Will she say yes to so much grief and such unfolding all in one? This day, a day that brings with it a faintly religious feeling, the monastic cells, the crucifixes on the walls, but also the gift shop, the restrooms, the piazza of St. Mark's, its sun too hot. She steps into this space and brings already in her mind the flight behind, the longer flight to come, the movies, the delays at customs, then the old routine back home. Will she say yes and harder keep on saying yes? Can the two embrace, the one stiff-winged, intent, the other so-so young and moon-faced, come from two such different worlds into this silent, deep, pictorial space with its delicate, arched Corinthian columns, the air so still it seems as if it waits, this foreground and this floor so swept, immaculate, even of shadows, and the whole scene balanced by that flat little garden to the left, at once edged oddly with a plain plank fence and sprinkled with those mysterious white flowers. Well, as I said, I think of myself as an urban kind of guy, but when you live with a bird watcher, birds show up a lot. And this poem is also rhymed. It's called The Bird in Our Garage. We don't actually have a garage, but this is really a meditation on kind of our responsibilities and on the generosity of impulse and its limitations. And it kind of feels appropriate to me to read now because You know, we're so often trying to balance, you know, responding with our hearts to disasters that are appearing all around the globe, and also balancing at the same time the need to do the hard, steady, long-term work of building a more fair, more compassionate society and world. So this poem's called The Bird in Our Garage. Out with the garden tools, old paint and padlocks, dwarfed by the big chest freezer and our cars. We keep an unfledged robin in a cardboard box, covered with mesh, set on some folding chairs. So young, we have to poke raw burger down its gullet twice an hour, thralls to its shrill squeak. Poor scruffy thing. Confetti, black, white, brown. It stares up at us and spreads its demanding beak. Meanwhile, on our backyard hillside and beyond, every sparrow, starling, robin but this one, lives and dies, squabbles, feeds, and chatters on, without our aid or even our attention. For a bird, we run and get the garden gloves, shred up the Sunday paper for its nest, and call the vet, without once thinking of the human miseries we read on which it rests. Still, here I am, toothpick in hand, poised above the startling yellow mouth, now bending close, my awkward parody of mother love. It makes me wonder which would be the worst. For us to learn by reason to ignore the heart's unreasoned promptings, or run instead to get the gloves, the cardboard box, and poor hurt bird, imagining that made us good.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Richard St. John, reading from his new book, The Pure Inconstancy of Grace. I want to ask you about travel in your poems. The voice in your poems travels quite a long way in terms of content, from the streets of Blahnox to Florence to Walden Pond, and then to the worlds of Heidegger, Martin Luther, and St. Julian. It's almost like we could go anywhere, back in time, other continents. So can you talk about that travel in your work?
Well, let me start as a literalist for the moment and not go to the figurative. I mean, I don't travel a lot, but when I do, I really enjoy it. And of course, you know, that's where you pick up a lot of material, because things seem fresh to you, and I think one's able to see a little bit more clearly and look a little bit more intently when you're out of your own sort of normal terrain. As far as mental travel, I don't think of what I'm doing as being so much different than, you know, kind of what most other people are doing, engaging with, you know, either the things you're seeing daily or the things you're reading. And I just happen to like poems that, you know, aren't afraid to bring in some ideas don't feel they have to be entirely immediate. And that's the kind of poem I like, and not surprisingly, is the kind of poem I kind of like to write.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just surprised by the range of it, because you also have, you know, there's a poem entitled Something to Do with the Dennis Public Dump. Which I love that poem. And I just think you don't often see books of poems with the public dump in one title and then, you know, references to St. Julian. It's just a really far-ranging thing in your work, which I think is terrific.
Well, thank you. Although I think we might all owe some of that to Pittsburgh. It gives all of us the gift of some sense of the kind of grittiness around us and some kind of appreciation of that. And so while I'd love to take credit for it, I think we're all products of our context as well.
Right. Also, you have some family poems or poems with family in them, and you have a great way of writing about family and love without getting sentimental. Could you talk about the craft of that? Is that something that you work against? Because you really have a lot of emotion in your work, but it never gets sentimental.
I'm glad to hear that, because I think I worry about that. And maybe that's how I work against it. I think the thing I try to do is to try and remember that there's a reader at the back end of the poems, and that I want to try and do something that feels honest to me, but at the same time is going to be, I hope, interesting to a reader. And I must confess that my, you know, biggest fear, particularly when you're writing a kind of thoughtful, meditative poems, is that someone will listen and say, well, that was kind of boring.
Well, yeah. I mean, we have no control over how readers take in our work, but no, boring is definitely not something I would think of in relation to your work.
But I think it's true that different readers are going to respond and to different things, and different things are going to resonate with different people. And of course, you know, there are going to be some tremendous, tremendous poets that I'm going to respect, but may not be the ones I keep turning to.
Exactly. Yeah, it's hard to say what hooks us and keeps us coming back. Poetry drug. So why don't you read a few more poems?
Okay. Well, I'm glad you asked about family, because I really did kind of want to close with this poem that's for my mother. She's really adventurous, still in her 80s, just recently took a trip to Ireland and Iona in Scotland. This poem's called All Souls Flight. Here and there, a pool of reading light. Passengers shift pillows, try to sleep. Near 80, you're moving toward a place none of us has been. Iona, Ireland. The Book of Kells. A soul page turned each month. If one stayed, you say, you'd see it all. Where saints, birds, beasts, fish, flowers illuminate the Celtic cross. A place of silence, stone, and waves, and stars. Four rows ahead, a child wails, has been howling for an hour. Nothing can comfort it. Its pure cry of want makes the whole plane uneasy in its wish, its inability to quite forgive that raveled howl. But you think only of the child. You go to help. You touch the mother's shoulder with a quiet palm. No, there's nothing you can do. You sit again. A stewardess steps past you in the dark. Now I imagine you think of us, the souls you help bring up. Babies, beasts, those years. The Book of Kells and where the manuscript breaks off. The waves invisibly beneath you, rushing past. You drift. You almost sleep. Headed toward morning, with that earthly keening in your ears.
Sorry we're out of time, Richard. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much.
It's the poetry of Richard St. John, reading from his new book, The Pure Inconstancy of Grace. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment newsweekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineer is Joseph Wilk. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, independent public radio, 91.3 WYEP.